Hello guys, welcome back to another episode of Musings of a Tired Nigerian Girl. Let's get into it.
Happy weekend everyone. My name is Maria Moni and I'm so excited to be with you the Family Show by Ben Okri alongside brilliant women. In today's podcast episode, you'll listen to me read chapters 7, 8 and 9. So before we get started, don't forget to follow the Tired Nigerian Girl podcast on Spotify.
Seven. I heard something rattling the roof. It had started to rain. The wind beat against the window. I got out of bed, crazed with hunger. I sat on the floor, huddled in the dark. And when there was a knock, I didn't even move. The door opened and a giant figure said, "Come and eat with us." Mesmerized by hunger, I followed the man to the dining table. I sat down mostly and stared at the flies singing about the food. The police officer's wife filled my plate with generous quantities of pounded yam, choice selections of goat meat and soup rich in vegetables. The food smelt wonderful and the steam from the bowl occupied the room with its tomato and oregano seasonings. My hunger made the world seem bluish. For the first time, I understood the atmosphere of the house. I understood why the spirit had entered me. When I blinked, I saw ghosts around the police officer and his wife. They were all over the room. The goats were tall and silent, some had weak beards. An incubus with white wings hovered near the window. I blinked again and saw a spirit with 8 fingers and a single twinkling eye. Another, in a policeman's uniform, had an amputated foot. He ate of the food with blood-stained hands a moment before the officer did. A ghost existing as only a pair of milk-white legs balanced on the head of the woman. A homunculus which looked like a yellow plant danced on the food. I must have been staring at them in astonishment, for the officer suddenly said, "What are you staring at?" I shook my head. Then I noticed that in a corner across from me, where they ate with such innocent relish, sitting forlorn and abandoned, was the ghost of their son. He had lost both his arms, one side of his face was squashed, and both his eyes had burst. He had bluish wings. It was the saddest ghost in the house. "Nothing," I said. They looked at one another, then at me. I couldn't bring myself to eat after seeing the ghosts play with the food with their bloodied hands. I sat and stared at the flies. When they had finished eating, they got up from the table. The man went to the armchair and his wife brought him a bottle of Guinness, which he drank with both feet on his stool. His wife joined him. I listened to the ticking of the grandfather clock in the silent house. The ghosts gathered around the man and wife and stared at them in silent amazement. The spirit with twinkling eye drank the froth of the Guinness a moment before the officer did. The officer drank contentedly, which is what. When his wife got up to fetch a soft drink for herself, the ghost with milk-white legs went with her. When the officer went to the toilet, the spirit in uniform accompanied him, and when they were sitting peacefully, the ghost stood in front of them, so close that their faces almost touched. The ghosts were silent and did nothing. The grandfather clock chimed. I realized that the ghost and spirit were in the house because the officer had somehow been responsible for their deaths. I hurried to my room, shut the door and lay in the dark, staring at the ceiling. When the clock started chiming, an orange light suddenly shot through my brain and darkness became faintly illuminated, and I saw the disconsolate ghost of the boy in a corner of the room. After a while, it got up and floated towards me and stared down with its burst eyes and lay just above me. Its wings tearing the air. I felt oppressed. I couldn't breathe and couldn't move. It was impossible to sleep, and when I managed to shut my eyes, I had the horrible feeling that a heavy form was pressing down on me, compacting itself into my body. I couldn't scream, and I struggled in vain. The walls in the house began to whisper about the seventh man and of how he had been run over by a lorry while directing traffic. As the form pressed itself into me, it began to rain outside. And I became calm. It rained steadily. The wind kept rattling the corrugated roof and driving in water through the gaps in the window frame. It got cold. I turned and faced the wall. When I realized I could move, I got up and sat on the bed. The ghost of the boy was up on the ceiling, like a perpetual bluish haze. Thunder growled above the house and lightning cracked. The rain poured down and the wind faintly howling banged away at the window. Lightning struck again. It seemed intent on the house. The whole place, the window, the room lit up in a candent flash. After a while, I smelled smoke drifting in from under the door. The smoke filled the room and I began to cough. And when I ran out, I could barely see. The smoke was very thick, and when I made it to the kitchen, coughing and smarting in the eyes, I discovered that the place was on fire. I banged on the doors and the officer came out, his stomach sagging, his eyes red. "There's fire in the kitchen," I cried. After we fought the fire with buckets of water, the ghost stood around watching us. The woman kept weeping. The man cursed. The rain intensified. The kitchen became thoroughly wet. Rain poured in under the sitting room door and soaked the carpet. The wind broke a window and slugs and hairy caterpillars were blown in. Little snails appeared on the walls. Thunder clapped outside. Inside, the ghost of the boy wandered the house. Wandered right through his parents without recognizing them and without being affected by their distress. After we had successfully fought the fire and mopped the soaking floor, everyone went back to bed. I heard them toasting and whispering all night. I didn't sleep. In the early hours of the morning, before dawn had broken and when night was beginning to change mood, there were urgent knocks on the door. The door shook and the banging became so wild and erratic, it seemed as if the wind and thunder wanted to be let in. I hurried out of my room towards the door, but the man got there before me. I moved closer. There was a woman standing in the doorway, her hair bedraggled and wet. Her eyes distracted, her neck shrunk, her feet bare. The rain poured down on her mercilessly. There were dead cockroaches about her feet. I saw a rope around her neck, connecting her to the sky. The rope transformed into a thread of lightning. For a moment, I thought I had known her in another life or in the world of spirits. I pushed past the officer. I stood on the threshold then, with light in my head and hunger in my voice, I cried, "Mother." At first, she didn't move. She didn't seem to recognize me. She stared at me with empty eyes. After a short silence, she suddenly dropped all the things she had been carrying and embraced me. Without uttering a sound, then she lifted me up into the air and held me tightly to her warm, wet body. It. I was awoken by voices in the dark. I was on Mom's shoulder and I saw faces of women in the rain, faces lit up by lightning flash. They crowded us, arms outstretched, eyes warm. We were surrounded on all sides. The women touched me and looked at me as if I were a wonderful thing that had fallen from the sky. They fondled my hair, rubbed my skin, and felt my bones as if, in being lost and found, I belonged to all of them. I had brought with me a new hope. They too became reasons for staying on this earth to sometimes taste the joys of homecoming. Mom put me down. My legs were weak. Everything looked strange. Our new compound looked very old indeed. I walked on shaky feet, staggering, and Mom took my hand and steadied me. Then she led me to a room, opened the front door and pointing said, "Your father is waiting for you." There was a man asleep on the chair. I didn't recognize him. He had a bandage round his head and his arm was in a dirty sling. He was unshaven and his bare chest heaved as he snored. The room was very small. It was full of the mood of his sleep, of hunger and despair, sleepless nights and the gloom of candle smoke. On the center table in front of him, there was a half-empty bottle of Ogogoro, an ashtray and a packet of cigarettes. There was a mosquito coil on the table as well and its acrid smoke filled the air. The man sleeping on the chair was like a giant in fairy tales. His big feet were on the table. He slept very deeply, frightening me with great movements of his chest. When lightning flashed outside and the downpour increased, the man woke up. A stern look in his eyes. Then his eyes changed. They became big and bloodshot. Bewildered, he gazed around the room as if he had woken up in an alien world. Then he saw me in the doorway. For a long moment, he stayed like that. Caught in an enchantment, his arms stretched out, jumping up suddenly and with such energy that he sent the chair flying from underneath him. He rushed towards me. I ran round the table, he pursued me, and I ran the other way, keeping the table between us. I had no idea why I was running away from him or why he was running after me. When I found an opportunity, I fled screaming towards the door out of the room, but he caught me in the passage. Under the torrential rain, hollering, he kept throwing me up in the air, filling me with dread, and when he held me to him firmly so that I was overwhelmed with his great bristling energies and his quivering heart, I burst out crying. without knowing why. When the rain stopped, Mom stripped the dead boy's clothes off me and later burned them in kerosene and herbal fluids. The clothes burned for longer than expected. Her eyes bright with superstitions, she kept feeding the yellow and black flames with kerosene. When the clothes burned down to curriculums of ashes, she gathered them in a newspaper and went out in the dark towards the forest. On her return, she seized my hand, pushed me to the bathroom, which had many pits on the wall, and made me bath with a bucket of specially treated water. I had to use a brown soap which produced little foam. As I struggled to wash myself, Mom stayed outside the squalid bathroom and told me all that had happened since the night of the riot. The way she told it filled me with wonder about her. That night when the crowd separated us, the unleashed masquerade had pursued women across streets because they were not supposed to see its terrifying presence. She looked for me in every corner, under every car, had shouted my name where houses were burning, and when she went back home hoping I might be there, waiting, she learned that that too had disappeared. In one night, she said, I lost my only child and my husband. She stayed up the whole night, outside the burnt compound, with all her possessions scattered about the streets. In the morning, the tenants moved to new compounds, to different ghettos. Mom managed to distribute her property among relations. Then she went to all hospitals and police stations she could find. She walked the whole city, inconsolable in her loss, and when she was about to succumb to despair, in a last effort she went to a police station in the center of the city and was told that Dad was there, imprisoned for taking part in the riots. She managed to see him. He had been beaten by the police, and there was an ugly cut on his forehead, bruises on his face, and his arm hung beside him like a diseased appendage. The next day, after much begging and some bribery, Dad was freed. He went to work that day and found that he had been sacked. During that time, Mom had succeeded in finding a room for us to rent. She had also found a way to pay a month's rent in advance. Dad came to his new home bad-tempered and in a violent mood. He fell ill that night, muttering about insane soldiers who had killed white men in wars across the sea. Mom was frantic over my disappearance. Her friend suggested consulting a herbalist. At first, she was doubtful, but after she had tried everything and had failed, gone to police stations and hospitals and been unable to find me, she relented. She was taken to a herbalist. There was a mound of broken glass in front of her hut. Mom had barely stepped in when the herbalist, a fierce-looking woman with one eye that glittered more than the other, told her from the shadows that she knew the purpose of Mom's visit. "Go away," she shouted in a cracked voice. "Bring me a white cockerel, a bottle of gin, feathers of a dove, and 3 pieces of chalk. Then I will help you." When Mom returned with items, the woman, attired in a severe black smock, consulted her cowries. She made offerings to her goddess, who sat in a corner of the room, brooding in the dark with shining sunglasses. Then she told Mom to leave. She wanted to sleep on her divination. Mom came back the next morning, and without any preamble, the herbalist told her that the fee would be very expensive because the case was very difficult. "Your son is trapped in a house of ghosts," she said. Mom was so terrified that she left instantly, gathered all the money she had saved from her trading, took some of Dad, and buried the rest. The herbalist went to tell her that I was being held by a man and a woman who either wanted to make me their own child or sacrifice me for money, and that I was surrounded with such powerful spells that if Mom didn't act quickly, I would be lost to her forever. Mom paid the fee and sat in the dark, listening as the strange-eyed herbalist embarked on the most extravagant conjuration she had ever witnessed. The herbalist wrestled with powers of the house, trying to break the spell surrounding me. After 5 hours, during which Mom sat rigid with fear, the woman emerged from her secret chambers and said, "I have broken all spells except one. That one is too powerful for me. Only lightning can break that spell." Mom sat confused. The herbalist gave out instructions. Mom went home, her heart heavy. That night she was lamenting her condition, blaming herself for having lost the only child she had, a child who had chosen to live, when a distant relation paid a visit. She had heard of Mom's troubles and had come to offer consolation. She brought a few gifts and congratulated Mom on finding me. Dad took it as a good omen. Mom was puzzled. Then it emerged that the relation had seen a picture of me in the newspaper on the day after my accident. That was how Mom traced me to the police station and eventually to the police officer's house. Mom went back to the herbalist, who now gave her the final set of instructions. Mom was to go to the house to be humble, to thank the officer and his wife for keeping me, to take them presents, and to throw the white cockerel into the house so they could transfer their sacrifice from me to the bed. and then she was run away from the place as fast as her legs could carry her. But before she could do any of this, lightning had to first strike the house. Mom had waited in the rain outside the house for 3 hours. She had stood patiently with thunder growling above her, watching as lightning flashed in different places over many houses and trees, and she had stayed like that, not moving an inch, till lightning struck directly over the house of Ghost where I was held captive. After I had bathed, after I had eaten, they made me sit in Dad's chair and asked me to tell them my story. I began telling them when the lights changed in the room and mighty hands lifted me up and put me on the bed. I saw Dad smiling beneath his bloodied bandage. Mom shifted the chair and center table, spread out a mat and slept on the floor. Dad sat on his wooden chair, smoked peacefully and lit a mosquito coil. I listened to him talking to the silent room, asking riddles that only the dead can answer. I slept all night and all day. When I woke up, it was evening. The room was empty. A kerosene lamp burned steadily on the center table. When I first opened my eyes to the new world of home, everything was different. Large shadows everywhere made the space smaller. The floor was rough. Long columns of ants crawled alongside the walls. There were ant mounds near the cupboard. An earthworm stretched itself past Dad's shoe. Wall geckos and lizards scurried up and down the walls. At the far corner of the room, a washing line was slack with the weight of too many clothes. Mom's objects of trade were all over the place. Her sacks were piled around the cupboard. Blackened pots and crockery and basins were scrambled everywhere. It was as if Mom and Dad had moved in, dumped their possessions wherever there was space, and had never found time to arrange anything. The more I took in the cracks in the walls, the holes in the zinc ceiling, the cobwebs, the smell of earth and gary, the cigarette and mosquito coil smoke, the more it seemed we hadn't moved at all. Everything felt same. The only difference was that I wasn't used to the sameness. The light in the room was dull in the evening. Mosquitoes and fireflies had come in. A dying fly buzzed its last song up on the ceiling among the net of cobwebs. The lamplight kept fluttering. Its black smoke drifted up the ceiling. The smell of burning wick and kerosene smoke reassured me. I was home, and being at home was very different from being in a comfortable house of the police officer. No spirit plagued me. There were no ghosts in the dark spaces. The poor also belonged to one country. Our surroundings were poor. We didn't have a bathroom worth speaking of, and the toilet was crude. But in that room, in our new home, I was happy because I could smell the warm presence and the tender energies of my parents everywhere. Hanging on crooked nails on the walls, there were framed browning photographs of my parents. In one of the pictures, Mom sat sideways on a chair. She had a lot of powder on her face. She had the coy smile of a village maiden. Dad stood next to her. He had on a baggy pair of trousers, a white shirt, and an askew tie. His coat was much too small for him. He had a powerful, tigerish expression on his face. His strong eyes and his solid jaw dared the cameraman. He looked the way some boxers do before they become famous. There was another photograph in which I sat between them, small between two guardians. There were smiles of shy sweetness on our faces. As I stared at the photograph in that little room where the lamp produced more black smoke than illuminations, I wondered where the sweetness had gone. I went out searching for Mom and Dad. They weren't in the backyard. In the kitchen, women sat in front of a blazing wood fire, sweat dripping from their faces, their fleshy arms and partly bared breasts glistening. I watched them as they fried bean cakes, chicken and fish, and as they prepared delicious smelling stews. When they saw me, they raised their voices in bright greetings and I fled. At the house front, Dad was narrating his prison experience to a rowdy gathering of men. Mom was across the road, haggling with an old woman. Dad got to a point in his narration where he thought it necessary to illustrate a particular action. He leaped up from his chair, bristling with good humor, and began marching up and down, stamping his foot on the earth, swinging his one good arm, dangling his head, and shouting war charges in 7 languages. It was meant to be an impersonation of the insane soldier who had fought the British wars in Burma. His mind had been unhinged by the blast of detonators. Nights spent with cubs and by many superstitions, incredulity of having killed so many white men, he had become a man who knew only 2 things, how to march and how to charge. He marched all day long in prison and he charged all night long in his sleep. The men laughed at Dad's impersonation and Dad laughed at and dad laughed so explosively that the bloody patch riding on the bandage round his forehead. No one noticed. I made a sound. Dad turned and saw me. And when he saw me, he abruptly stopped laughing. After a long moment, he started moving towards me and I ran across the street. Towards Mom. Halfway across, I saw a bike lady pedaling furiously at me. Mom screamed. I fell. The bike lady wobbled, missed my head and cursed as he sped away. Mom rushed over, picked me up and took me back to the house front and gave me to Dad to look after. Why do you keep running away from me, eh? Dad asked with sadness. I said nothing. I stared at the faces of the compound men, big faces stamped with hardship and humor. The night slowly descended on us and the kerosene lamps came alight one by one along the street. That evening, Dad became the guardian giant who led me into the discoveries of our new world. We were surrounded by a great forest. There were thick bushes and low trees between the houses. The bushes were resonant with the trillings of birds and crickets. That led us down a narrow path. We passed women with bundles of firewood on their heads, walking along and talking in strange languages. We passed young girls returning from distant streams with buckets of water balanced on their heads. Do you see all this? Dad said, waving his good arm to indicate the forest and the bushes. Yes, I replied. It's bush now, isn't it? Yes. But sooner than you think, there won't be one tree standing. There will be no forest left at all. And there will be wretched houses all over the place. This is where the poor people will live. I looked around again in amazement, for I couldn't see how the solid forest could become so different. Dad chuckled. Then he was silent. He put his hand on my head and with the voice of a sad giant, he said, "This is where you two will live. Many things will happen to us here. If I ever have to go away, if I ever disappear now or in the future, remember that my spirit will always be there to protect you." Dad's voice quivered. When he was silent again, I started to cry. He lifted me with his powerful arm and carried me on the rock of his shoulder. He made no attempt to console me. When I had stopped crying, he chuckled mysteriously. We stopped at the first palm wine bar we came across. He ordered a gourd of palm wine and kept teasing the woman who served him and who kept topping off my tiny glass. When Dad drank from his half calabash, I drank from my glass. It made Dad happy. He said, "Learn to drink, my son. A man must be able to hold his drink because drunkenness is sometimes necessary in this difficult life." I sat beside him on the wooden bench, drinking as he drank, taking in the smells of the bar, its odors of stale wine, pepper soup, and fish sacks. Flies were exultant everywhere. While talking, the clientele kept waving them off from their faces. At a corner of the bar, on a far bench, in the half light of the lanterns, a man sat with his back against the wall, his head fluffed in drunkenness as he dozed. Dad ordered another gourd of wine. His face glistening with delight, he exchanged jokes and anecdotes with the clientele who were all present strangers. Then he began a game of draughts. At first, he played without seriousness, joking all the while. He played a game in this spirit and won. He played another and lost. He joked less the more he lost. His voice grew more aggressive and he hit my head with his sharp elbows without noticing. The two men became so obsessed with their game that they began to accuse one another of cheating. Their fists waved threateningly about the drug board. Their voices became heated. The onlookers who had placed bets on the players were even more passionate than those who were playing. Dad, losing steadily, abused his opponent violently. His opponent replied with incredible vehemence. I got worried. Dad placed an absurd bet on himself and his opponent doubled it. Things suddenly got very tense in the bar and Dad drank heavily, sweating. He ordered two more gourds of wine. It got so tense that when the onlooker said anything, they would be pounced upon. It took long, anxious moments to quell the furious exchanges. Dad increased the bet and his head started bleeding again. His opponent, a huge man with a small head, kept staring at Dad with such contempt that I wanted to bite his fingers. He turned to me with his small, drunken eyes and said, "Your father doesn't know how to play." "Shut up," I snapped. There was a startled silence. "What did you say?" he asked incredulously. "Nothing," Dad said. "Leave my son alone. Play the game. Use your brains, not your mouth." His opponent, consumed with indignation, said, "You mean to tell me that you allow that small boy whose mother's liquid hasn't yet dried on his head to abuse me. Play, my friend, Dad said coolly. You don't bring up children like that where I come from, the man said, glowering at me. My friend, play your game. The man got so angry at Dad's indifference that his concentration was entirely thrown off balance. He kept fuming at me, swearing in many languages. Dad beat him steadily, drinking less, the closer victory seemed. And then, with a devastating flourish, he won the set of games and swept his opponent's hard-earned money into his pocket. His opponent, in an extreme fit of bad temper, drank down the entire contents of his gourd of palm wine, rained insult on us, complained bitterly about the contemporary bad breeding of children, and staggered out into the enroaching darkness. It turned out that he had left without paying for his drinks and his pepper soup. The madame of the establishment ran after him, and we heard them squabbling. Dad finished off his gourd with perfect serenity. He was very pleased with himself, and his face shone with profound satisfaction. When I had finished my wine in my tiny glass, he paid the madame's assistant and we left. Outside, a crowd had gathered. The bad-tempered loser refused to pay the madame for the simple reason that I had told him to shut up. I won't pay till you tell that boy to apologize to me, he shouted. That is not my business, she bellowed back. All I want is my money. The boy insulted me in your bar, he replied. The woman stopped listening. When we went past the crowd, we saw that she was dragging him about, yanking him around by the pants. He kept trying to free himself from a masterful grip on his trousers, a grip which encompassed his private parts. He tried to pry her hands apart. When that failed, he took to hitting her hands, screaming insults at everyone. Then suddenly, to our astonishment, the woman lifted him up by the pants and threw him on the ground. The crowd yelled. The man played, got up, shouted and huffed. Then he pounced on her, lashing at her face. Dad started towards him, but his rescue attempt was cut short. The madame grabbed the bad loser's crotch and he screamed so loud that the crowd fell silent. Then with a practiced grunt, she lifted him off her shoulders, turned him around once, showing his mightiness to the sky, and dumped him savagely on the hard earth. He stayed unconscious for a while. His mouth open, she had then proceeded to turn him upside down, emptying out all the money in his pockets. She took what she was owed, stripped him of his trousers, went into the bar, came back out with a filthy gourd, and drenched him with stale palm wine. He recovered instantly. When he saw the fullness of his public disgrace, he screamed in disbelief and fled towards the forest, his underpants dripping with the shame of stale wine. We never saw him again. The crowd was so amazed at the woman's performance that everyone stared at her with their mouths wide open. The woman went back into her bar and cleared the tables as if nothing happened. Then as we looked on, she broke the draught board in half and threw it outside. When she looked up and saw the crowd staring at her in mesmerized silence, she strode towards us. In a loud voice, hands on hips, she said, "Do you want to drink or do you want to look?" The crowd, awoken from the spell, broke up into numerous voices. Some went into the bar to drink of amidst. Others went back to their different areas, taking with them the embellished stories of the most sensational drama they had witnessed for a long time. The woman served a new clientele with superb nonchalance. That evening was the beginning of her fame. Everyone talked about her in low voices, her legend, which would sprout a thousand hallucinations, had been born in her midst, born of stories and rumors, which in time would become some of the most extravagant realities of our lives.